Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live the good life and create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. Edgy Ideas is proudly sponsored by the Eco Leadership Institute. We offer coach and leadership training courses, and we have a vibrant community of practice where international members join once a month for a webinar. Our focus is on co-creating the good society. To find out more, go to www.ecoleadershipinstitute.org, and to read my polemic blogs and essays, go to Simon Western at Substack. Thank you for listening. So welcome everybody to this edition of Edgy Ideas podcast. Today's very special guest is Nora Bateson. Nora is an award-winning filmmaker, writer, and educator, and she's a founder and president of the International Bateson Institute, which is based in Sweden, where she lives. Her work asks the question, how can we improve our perception of the complexity we live within so we may improve our interaction with the world? She's an international lecturer, researcher, and writer, and she wrote and produced the award-winning documentary An Ecology of Mind, which is a portrait of her very famous father, Gregory Bateson, the systemic thinker. Nora is also author of Small Arcs of Larger Circles, and she's got a new book coming out, or just about out, called Combining, which is a very rich book, and we're going to explore that today. And she's also founder of the concept of warm data. Nora, you're very welcome to Edgy Ideas. How are you today?
I'm great, and thank you for having me. And I hope that we can take the opportunity to get edgy.
Yeah, let's get edgy. We had a bit of a pre-chat and talked about it's Halloween. We got Diwali coming up. We got the spirits around us. So let's see where that infuses into our work. I've skim read your work Combining. I'm looking forward to getting the whole book and deep diving. It's a beautiful book. What kind of inspired you to write Combining?
Well, it was interesting because it's not the book I was supposed to write. I was supposed to write a book on warm data. And there's something in the warm data theory base. Okay, so it may seem as though the concept of warm data is like feelings and just the fluffy stuff and the stuff that is, you know, not measurable. But actually, there's a lot of very sophisticated theory under the warm data practice. And I have been sort of intending to go beyond the training courses to provide a book on how these theories combine. Okay. Yeah. But what kept happening, and what I've seen again and again in my life working with systemic practice, is that there's a whole lot of talking about systems and about complexity. And that somehow that aboutness misses the actual complexity. So it's as though in the language and the process of discovery in an existing epistemology and an existing set of, you know, semantic and semiotic practices, we take the thing that's alive and moving and very complex and lots of patterns in play and so on, and we flatten it.
Yeah, yeah.
And so what I was trying to do was actually bring something that I had the remarkable fortune to be just around and within from the time I was tiny. My father was working with systemic practice, and he was not only talking about it, he was living in it. So this work that he did was not just an intellectual pursuit, it was a way of life. And as his child, I had that way of life as the basis of a way of being. And so then when I got older and I started working more directly with systemic and systemic theory and complexity theories, I just kept feeling like I'm beating up against the side of this problem of the same thinking that is creating the separation is actually finding the words to describe the system, and it's killing it.
Yeah.
So how do we give it life?
Yeah, that's really interesting, because that's according to my own experience that, you know, I mean, I came across your father's work as a family therapist way back, and it's just so inspiring, and I got very interested in systems, complexity kind of work, and open systems thinking, and all that work. But like you say, there's something deadening in it. There's something kind of gets killed in the spirit of it kind of dies, and we look at it from outside, and we map all these systems, and we draw these kind of communication feedback loops and stuff. And yet the experience of living it is kind of is lost. So I think you're absolutely right, and your book really speaks to living it as you've just described.
I wanted to address this idea that runs through the whole book on an ecology of communication. And the notion here is really that you are an ecology. I am an ecology.
Yeah.
And as such, you are your intellectual self. You are your emotions, your experiences. You are your body. You are your culture. You are your, you know, you are your microbiome. You're part of nature. You're your spiritual practices. And so if I really want to convey an idea to you, that idea needs to be able to be expressed through all those different versions of us.
Yeah.
And so I don't want to just have the discussion of complexity get stuck in the diagrams and the vocabulary of complexity theory, because that is about complexity, but it's not the complexity, right? It's a map and territory problem.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. And what are you doing this when you're working? Do you want to say something about your warm data work and just tell us a bit about that and how you kind of work this live with practitioners and with people?
Yeah. So, okay, there's a couple of things to get to sort of parse out here.
Yeah.
And one of them is the idea of warm data is that there is information that is relational information that's moving through multiple contexts. And so it's transcontextual information.
Mm-hmm.
That word transcontextual is a word that my father coined.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is information that's everywhere all the time, but it doesn't make it onto the it doesn't make it onto the invoice. It's just not there on the clipboard. It's not there in the analysis, because it is slippery. Okay. Mm-hmm. When the perception changes from context to context. Okay, let's say this. Who is Simon? And if I, you know, ask your childhood friends or your high school friends, I'll get a whole different picture than I will if I ask your professional colleagues or the people, you know, your first lover or, right? Mm-hmm. So who are you? And you're different with some people than you are with others. And that capacity for you to be in an ecology of relationship and communication is, for me, a source of incredible hope and flexibility and possibility. So this warm data world is a world where there's all this information, but it doesn't act like normal information. It's information that's alive. So I'm asking the question, what would information look like if it was as alive as the world we're in? So that would mean that it would change. It would be slippery. It would be blurry. It would look very different from different directions. And for some people, this sounds really abstract. I think it's actually much less abstract than the idea that you can actually freeze information in a world that's never frozen. So then that's the warm data as warm data. Then there's the warm data lab and the online version of that process, which is called People Need People. Mm-hmm. Those are processes that are practices.
Yeah.
You know, because in order after, you know, several hundred years of indoctrination and education and epistemologies that shattered our capacity to actually perceive relational process, we're dealing with a fragmented world.
Yeah.
And while I look to Indigenous cultures to you know, with awe and honor, to perceive the depth mm-hmm. of that wholeness, what I also see is that there is a broken world that you can't just apply that wholeness to and hope it sorts. So the warm data practices are really created to allow for a kind of retissuing of mm-hmm. a fragmented world. And that's a practice. And most of this stuff is happening nonverbally. Most of it is happening in very surprising ways that don't look like what we think we're looking for.
Yeah.
So those are the warm data lab and the warm data. And they're different. So in the practice of the warm data lab, there's a question. And again, there's a lot of theory under this. So it's not like a prêt-à-porter thing. People do the training that I give, and some people have done it 12 times, and mm-hmm. it's a week-long hard course, which I love to teach, unless you do it online, in which case it's 3 weeks long.
Okay.
but the idea is you have a question, which is an open-ended process. So immediately we're opening up a question like, what is home in a changing world? Okay, there is no one answer to that.
No.
So the question invites an exploration through multiple contexts. And so the group will move, for example, there'll be a few people at a station that's like on ecology, and one on economy, and one on politics, and one on health, and one on education, and one on history, and one on technology, etc., family. And then people just move around the room, and they as they want to. I don't guide their timing. I don't tell them what to talk about, and I don't tell them what they should get out of it. Mm-hmm. The whole business here is that there is something allowed to find its own connections.
Yeah.
And to grow and to make impressions that maybe invite other impressions. And, you know, you find yourself telling stories you haven't told for decades. Mm-hmm. Things, people you haven't thought about, but it's this way in which there is this healing, I don't use that word lightly, because it can become a linear process, and I'm not interested in that.
Sure.
But there's something that can begin to take place in the practice of perceiving relational process. And then my hope is not that you're going to go out there and create some model to save the world and sell it to the United Nations. My hope is that you're actually going to perceive your own family differently.
And
start right there. And that when you actually start to perceive the world differently in the throes of your own relational dramas at home, then maybe we can talk about the big picture. But there's, you know, I've been around an awful lot of complexity theorists that treated their family and their partner and their kids like crap. And I'm sorry, if you can't do relational process at home, you can't do it anywhere.
Yeah, no, that's very true. And I mean, you're saying things which are very, very pleasing to me, because we work in the Ecology Institute, and we're doing similar work about practice, how we embody this work, how we make these connections, how we do relational work. One, I'm going to ask you to do a couple of readings from your book, because it's such a beautiful book, in a moment. But before we go there, when I do a lot of work in organizations, and we're trying to kind of open up this space where people can think more ecosystemically, ecology, you know, similar kind of types of work, there's different responses. The modern world is a very linear world, and the modern world silos things. It creates kind of labels. It the whole purpose of modernity is to separate in some sense, and we see that it's really deep within us. It's hard to kind of let go of that, I find. You know, even people who kind of like your work, they like systemic work, they like kind of others' work, but they actually find it, they return very quickly to that place, because that we're so kind of entrenched in that, and some of the work is to let go of that. Some other people kind of, so we're very separate from nature. Other people kind of say we're part of nature, and go to place that we just have to follow what nature does. And yet humans have developed themselves in a very kind of human way. And I wonder what your kind of thoughts are about those two kind of like split off or totally immersed and where you see humanity within that.
Okay, perfect. So it's this time of year.
Mm-hmm.
And at this time of year, this is actually October 31st that we're talking, but when you air this, it'll probably be in the next few days or something.
Yeah.
And at this time of year, there is an interest in the veil between the worlds, the ancestors and the lights, and the whether it's Diwali or Samhain or the Day of the Dead or the there's all sorts of traditions that honor this time of year. So I thought it would be fun in our edgy way to play with this. And I think bringing it right in on this question, because this is where I see that, and in my language, what I speak about quite frequently is the ghosts.
Yeah.
And so there are these ghosts that live in the way that we perceive the world. And mm-hmm. they're hiding in our language. They're hiding in our expectations of what life is. What is life, right? And what do you teach your children about what they need to know about life? And how are we teaching our children to live in a system that is actually totally destructive to their future and telling them they can't survive if they don't do it? You have to get good grades. You have to go get a job. You have to do well on the test. You have to you have to not feel this feeling of stress, and you have to just do well on the test.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's also there in the process of, all the process of categorizing, whether you're categorizing economic mm-hmm. processes or health conditions or mental health conditions or IQ tests, these things have their roots in a very dark moment.
Yeah.
And that dark moment is connected to colonialism. It's connected to control. It's connected to industrialization and the way in which there was an outcome that was predetermined for living wild processes, like learning to be in the world.
Mm-hmm.
There's no one way to learn to be in the world. I mean, one time my father was actually asked, how would you define sanity? And that this is actually in combining. And his response was, he didn't want to give a response, first of all. He didn't like the question. But when he did finally give it, he said, sanity is familiarity with your own epistemology. Now that's interesting. Right? Because it shows us that in all different cultures, in all different times, over the last several thousand years of human existence, what was sanity?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
obviously it changed.
Yeah, sure.
So for me, this question you're asking is really about watching out for these ghosts and admitting that we have habits of doing things that are destructive.
Mm-hmm.
And creating categories that decontextualize, that pull things violently out of relational process and recontextualize them into an industrial context.
Yeah.
So it's not that we don't have context, it's that the context doesn't like context.
Sure.
So then your second part of this question is, well, we are nature, so we just have to do what nature does. But there's a trick in there.
There is.
There's a trick, and that is nature according to whom?
Yeah.
And this has always been a problem mm-hmm. because nature according to my kids or my dad was very different than nature according to a lot of the indigenous tribes. So it's very difficult not to take the basic understandings of relational process that have been deeply imprinted onto anyone who's been through the school systems.
Yeah.
And to not apply them to nature. And what I see all the time is people talking about nature as though it were basically a large machine.
Yes.
With functions and purposes, and that it's squishier, it's, you know, messier, but very often we see the habits of thinking. Of linear causality, of decontextualized process. And in fact, we get told a tree is a tree. Okay, I don't know how you get there from understanding nature, because in fact, the tree is only possible because of millions of organisms being in relationship. So where's the edge of the tree? And so I think this is what you're pointing to, is this ghost.
Yeah.
And it's the ghost that says, yeah, you can define it. You can map it. Mm-hmm. You can do it. In fact, I have this one piece. I'll read it to you. It's called...
Go.
Okay. It's called Lurking Monster. This is perfect for this time of year, right? But just to be clear, the whole book is not actually about autumnal liminality. This is just happens to be the day we're going to pull these pieces up.
Very good.
All right, Lurking Monster. There's a lurking monster whose familiar diet is measurement and control. It lives in language and wears costumes of assumption. The monster twists perception to match and confirm its rightness, unquestioned. The categories it craves are firmly delineated, confirmed as real, describing a non-world of non-living staticness. The monster loves to compare measurements. This is better than that. It crunches numbers, but defies their poetic beauty. Numbers are stories that shift and slip through each other, but the monster uses them otherwise, holds them captive in metric cruelty, biometrics, psychometrics. Divide and devour. Like Damascus steel, the confirmation of this habit is folded in on itself from 50 directions. Count the 50 folds if you must. List them, make a spreadsheet for them, but you will never control them. It's the stuff of economy, the basis of psychology, the shape of education, the law of the law, the mayhem of the health industry, and the soul of digital tech. The lurking monster will funnel the world into the proper slots of the forms, tick the boxes department by department. This will prohibit any healing, any change toward an ecological understanding of the world. It will seduce the process of saving communities and forests into authoritarianism, telling people how to live, think, and feel. Feed it open-ended processes and blurred edges. Unfold its thick-tongued speech of reductive confinements and let it see. Let's see what it does when it gets dizzy and lost. There, right there in the vertigo, the costumes of assumption are visible as such. The strings of the puppet are in sight, and the monster's influence becomes dusty, obsolete. There's no need to fight this terrible thing. Fighting makes it stronger. Better just to notice when it creeps into the moments of the day. When you see dog poop, don't step in it. You just don't. This is why I do what I do. So the lurking monster.
That's beautiful. I'm going to use that. I'm working in the humanitarian sector at the moment, and they have a problem with the monster. And I'm gonna get your reading because you read it so beautifully, and play it to them at the beginning of our next session. That was really you captured that beautifully. Thank you very much, Nora.
You're so welcome. And it's the problem of wanting so much. I mean, how many thousands, hundreds of thousands of people are out there right now doing beautiful work, the most beautiful work they know to do, with honest, earnest hearts of concern and high levels of integrity. And what pains me so much is when these ghosts creep in and they reshape everything into their own likeness.
Yes. Yeah.
And it's like we keep trying to create a new system by mirroring the old one with slightly different twists.
Yes.
But the underlying premise being there will be controlled outcome. And I guess for me, what this book is really about is about possibility.
Mm-hmm.
And about the weirdness of that possibility, the aliveness, the wildness of possibility.
Yeah, and yeah.
That most of the time, the thing that we're looking for is not the thing we're looking for. And the problem is you find the thing you're looking for.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
No, I mean, your thinking and the way you're talking is very countercultural. I mean, we are so embedded in this way of thinking. And like you say, you know, if the system's wrong, then we must change the system and we invent another machine. It's like the ghost comes over, restructures, and you get another machine, but it does the same thing as the first machine. It's it is very countercultural what you're saying. And I think this idea of small changes lead to bigger changes, this idea of your warm data labs, you know, you don't try and change the world. You're not going for a top-down change in a big organization. You're creating change with individuals and families, and it becomes systemic and moves in that way, as social movements do, as kind of in a kind of more viral way. It is very interesting.
And back to this ecology of communication, I think one mm-hmm. thing that I'm really... Okay, so I grew up in the 70s in California, so I've had my share of all this self-help, self-development, self, the era of the self.
Yes.
I'm fed up with it. And I love when I go to Norway and my friends say they're fed up, what that means is they've had enough dinner. But but anyway, I'm fed up. And fed up for me with that has pushed me into this recognition that's really come through warm data.
Mm-hmm.
That the question is not who can I be and how can I be a better person. The question is, who can you be when you're with me? And mm-hmm. who can I be when I'm with you? And when you ask that question, the implications and the work that has to happen for me to say, okay, but who can Simon be when he's with me? How do I make a space for Simon to be super intelligent, be funny, be loving, be real, be kind, be sexy, right? How do I invite that Simon into being that is in full bloom of life?
Yeah, yeah.
And allow your complexity, your pain, your traumas, your scar tissues to be here with me.
Mm-hmm.
And that is an ecological question.
Yeah.
Right? Where this question of how do we make the parts better? How do we fix the self? That's an industrial question.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see the difference?
Absolutely. No, absolutely. And it's something, I work with it. It's just opening up. It's opening a space and not having a set paradigm to step into as well. I mean, I think this is very important, what you said about your warm data, that you allow people to kind of self-organize, that they find their ways, and sometimes they'll bump into themselves again and they'll bump into the same ghosts, but they keep doing the work. And it's that way of working rather than this kind of top-down self kind of directive kind of a change model, isn't it, which kind of opens up the space. I think holding open a space is very interesting. Holding open a space to allow this sort of work is part of this, because the machine tells us we should direct that space. We should aim for a purpose, aim for a goal, aim for a task. What's the outcome going to be?
I'm going to read you another piece.
Go.
Okay. This piece is called Harvest. And again, it kind of fits into this time of year.
It does.
I actually had no idea that there was so much of this in here. But anyway, this is something that I really encourage people. So if there's about 800, more than 800 warm data hosts out there in the world, all over the place at this point.
Right.
And as warm data hosts, they have often, you know, all of us have felt the pressure to perform some social group activity like Warm Data Lab, and that there will be an outcome. Mm-hmm. And I mean, someone hires you to do it. You go into their organization, you do this thing, and then you're like, yeah, but there's no outcome. That's up to you. And that, you know,
that doesn't work.
That doesn't work. On the other hand, there's this clamor to decolonize, to go back to think in ecological ways, to change the system. Just don't really change it.
Yeah.
Right. So this is a piece that I wrote for the hosts so that they can actually read it if they want to at the end of a lab or with whoever. And it's called Harvest.
Thank you.
Be careful. A hasty harvest is an unfeeding. It is non-food. Harvests are patient history and quiet roots that start tiny. While compost is necessary for the growing season, do not eat the compost. Wait. The eggshells and onion skins bear little resemblance to the conversation at the table where the meal they fed feeds you. Wait. The industrial craving for instant food, ideas, and plans distracts from entering ecological time. An apple seed in the ground is not an apple. It requires seasons, years, changes in light, wind, temperature. It must reach up into the spring sun and down into the winter earth. Blossoms need the insects and the song of the baby birds. This is not the time to harvest. This is the time to let these ideas come to find other contexts in the underground, in the wilderness. Notice the unecology of the question, what is the point? A meadow never asks such a thing. Life is making life, nothing less. The harvest is a time of golden brown reds and deep orange tones. The harvest is marking the long journey into the squishy death and rot that offers new compost. It's the last moon before the cold comes. Do not race into winter before it's due. Harvest is long in its arrival. Sometimes it comes with an empty basket, leaving its lost leaves and roots to decompose, feeding the possibility of next year. Likewise, let the ideas and stories of today remain in the undergrowth. Let them find new contexts, new life. Let the movement of relating follow its own reachings. Let it touch and rename itself as it moves. This is the beginning. This is the middle. Let it form and inform. Do not ask what you will get out of this. This is the making of next year's rain. The point is the meadow of 100 years from now. Ecology is not instant. You cannot run to the shop and buy it. There is no summation, nothing to put in your pocket, only idea seeds in warmth and moist history. Relax. The possibilities are brewing, stewing. Let them wander and shape in ways you may never have considered.
Again, beautiful. Thank you very much. Great offering. The title of the poem, the reading, Harvest, the ecology of communication, I've been thinking a lot about this in the work. So I grew up in a family therapy, psychotherapy, psychoanalysis, language, and of course, learned a lot, and there's a lot of helpful insights from it. But again, it gets caught up. There's ghosts in there, lots of ghosts in there around science, around how it should be, and problems. In the work we're doing at the moment, I draw a lot on Donna Haraway's work. So we have rather reflective groups, which is all about the cognitive, the brain. We go to composting groups. We do harvesting, we do weaving. And it seems to me language is important. What do you think about kind of use of language in your work? So could you say something about that?
Oh, I mean, I absolutely. There's a whole chapter in the book on words to be careful with.
Okay.
And they're surprising words because they're words that are all over the work of change making.
Yeah.
And words that you would think would be okay. And they are meant with the best intention.
Sure.
But these ideas are soaked.
Yeah.
And we are all deeply soaked in ideas of linear causality. I mean, really, that's the you know, compartmentalized linear causal processes as a way to create optimization, productivity, efficiency. But these are the fruits of industry.
They are
not the fruits of living systems. And for all the good that they've given us, if there's not an understanding of really discretion, at what point, my dad used to say, I love this. He said, never use Newtonian physics to describe living systems. You know, you can talk about your car and you can pat your car on the dashboard and say, come on, old girl, let's go. You can make it up this hill. And that's one thing. Treating a machine like a living thing is one thing. And with AI coming, we've got questions about that.
Yeah.
But treating a living thing like a machine is incredibly violent.
Yes.
So the second you start to think you can fix your family with the same kind of instrumentalized concept that you might fix your pickup truck, you're in deep, deep water.
Yeah.
And then there's the consequences. And the problem is that systems, natural living systems, do not happen in first order.
No.
We see first order effects. Okay, so my kid's not doing well in math. I need to help them do well in math. And so then you try to solve the problem at the first order.
Yeah.
And when you do that, you're going to create 1,000 other consequences because the math class is in nth order. And what's actually serving that is not that he's not getting a good grade. It's that actually he doesn't care if he gets a good grade.
Yeah.
And so I could tell him he has to get a good grade, and I could push him, and I could hire tutors, and I could create a schedule, and I could control his life, and maybe I could squeeze a good grade out. But it's not even going to come close to mattering to him.
Yeah.
And that's the problem, is this nth order issue.
Yeah. And it does go, it goes very deep into the human change culture, you know, like I'm forever telling people, you know, they ask me what coaching tools I've got, and I don't have coaching tools, so I'm not fixing somebody, you know. It's like this language is just becomes part of the everyday, and it's your chapter is very right to kind of pull that out and question it. What would you like to say to my audience before we get towards the end of this podcast? What's on your mind at the moment in terms of your work and your thinking?
Well, I think one of the big pieces for me right now is actually the recognition of, there's a piece in this book called Creature. And the creature piece is a remembering that we are actually creatures.
Yeah.
And that when you get irritated because you're on voicemail and they've given you 4 options and none of them are what you want, or I got some bill from an Airbnb place today for $242 for a teapot that cost $25 because it's our policy, right? And I went through this on a very personal level with bringing my kids into Sweden, and the Swedish migration department, in their wisdom, accepted my son and rejected my daughter and separated our family based on the fact that she was 21 and she's no longer family. So there's this aspect, I think, of our creatureliness. And that means that we have daydreams, that we have small hairs, that we know when someone's lying to us, that we can actually stand in the absolute darkness and hear things that we could never hear if the lights were on, right? There's all of these aspects to being alive that are very important to remember right now. especially as AI is coming storming in. And I think that for me, as I look at my kids, I realize that I grew up in a world in which it was possible. You know, if I were renting a house from somebody, I would have a conversation with them and we would figure it out. Mm. We, you know, when we were kids, there was room to be in conversation with each other as human beings. And that's going fast. Yeah. And to the point that I think a lot of, I mean, I think my kids don't even know that it is possible.
Mm.
So they don't even try.
Yes. Yeah.
So I'm wanting that, you know, that sort of experience of the creature to come back and to celebrate being alive together. And that means that, you know, what does it feel like to be hungry? What does it feel like to be cold? What does it feel like? And all of, even to say this, you can hear the privilege in it.
Yes. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so somehow privilege and wealth have been a way to distance from being alive add technology to it. And you lose context. Okay. So, I mean, you're about the same age as me, I think. And I was recalling this story the other day of getting lost on my way to my grandmother's house in North Carolina. And so I was young. I had just gotten my license. I was maybe 17 years old. And I pulled over to the side of the road, okay, because we didn't have GPS then. Yeah. And I was alone in the car and I didn't have a map. So I actually asked a human being who in that era did not have headphones on. And I pulled over. I asked this guy, "Excuse me, do you know how to get to Alamance County Road?" And he was so great. He looked at me and he said, "Honey, the way you're headed is about 24,999 miles that way. But if you'll just turn yourself around, it's about a mile down that way." And there's so much in that story that's gone.
Yeah. Yeah, sure.
And that this memory, this sort of this recognition that we are losing the ability to see contextual process because we don't have to. I don't have to learn my way around cities anymore. My kids ask me, "How, you know, when you were young, like, how did you ever drive through New York City?" Like, okay, well, the first thing you do is go out to breakfast because you need to go out to breakfast and everybody needs to study the map that's in the car because we all need to know. So it starts with a good diner.
Yeah. Yeah. Very good.
So before we hang up, I would be doing you a disservice if I didn't read this one piece for you. And this really is about my kids. And that's, for me, this piece, you'll feel the complexity in it, but it's not about the complexity. Mm-hmm. It's about life. And I wrote this for my kids and it says sort of why I wrote the whole rest of the book.
Right.
And I'm looking for possibility. How do we give them possibility? It's called Mama Now.
Thank you.
Your eyes will see the derailing of assumptions. Your hands will hold the crumble of the old matrix. I do not have any authority to lean into. I have empty pockets where parents used to advise their children. I do not have any maps, myths, or mother wisdom for you. I can fix your breakfast, but not the culture. And when you ask about how to be a good person, I cannot lie to you. Everything you touch in a day is in some way bloodied. You have been born into an edgeless violence. But I will not judge or measure you against a bygone metric. I'm here too, ready to learn with you, unsure how to be or who to be. I can only read fragments of your worry, as the future is a horizon of confusion. I cannot protect you. And yet it's my only job. aching as I witness from this side of the hourglass. Other generations of parents knew the outlines, school, career, family, and retirement. But your life will be another shape entirely, forming in the fractures. When you say you need a goal, I offer you an expired ticket. Superficial memes roll off the tongue right into your bullshit detector. Success in the existing system is not going to do you much good. Your integrity is your rage, and I will nourish it. Your dignity is your curiosity, and I am tiny beside it. Your courage is your pain, and I will sing to it with you. We will riot together. We will notice the nuance of small graces in the day. We will wash the grit of loss for each other. I am your mama, and your future is the story of a storm. I am your cabin, your boots, your rucksack.
That was lovely again. Powerful. Powerful. We'll listen again.
And that goes for papas too.
Yeah, that's great. Before you go, Nora, we ask guests on the podcast at the end of the podcast the question, what does it mean to live a good life and create a good society? And I just wondered your reflections on that. You might pull the question apart even. I don't know if there's ghosts in that question for you, but we try and think about kind of what it means to kind of that big question around to live a good life and to create a good society. Any thoughts? Mm-hmm. You shared quite a lot already, but any final thoughts?
I mean, for me, I think it has to do with just learning together and creating that way in which we can learn together. And with some people, that's very difficult,
mm-hmm.
because the habit is to be right. And that authority and credibility and gravitas are created within a sort of waterproof world of being right and correct. And I learned from my father what it feels like, especially to be in intergenerational mutual learning,
mm-hmm.
right? Which does not mean the elders are passing down their wisdom to kids. That's in there.
Yeah.
But only because the elders are also wondering how in the world we're going to get through this.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a different texture. I think that poem that I just read holds that texture and this honesty of like, look, we're in really big trouble. And, yeah. And what does it look like to learn together? How do we find a way, not make a plan, but figure it out as we go, this process of improvisation, and what it means to, you know, I think this is what the Warm Data Lab is all about, is actually making a place to practice that kind of mutual learning and a kind of the catchy, trendy term is social resilience, which, you know, sounds a bit like,
yeah,
plastic-y, but you get what I'm saying. And sure. I think for me, the richness of that and the joy and the delight and the anguish, okay, it's all the same, is that people are weird and they do weird things and they're tangled up in their scar tissues and their histories and they're tangled up in ghosts and lurking monsters. And yet they're still beautiful.
Yeah, there's a real richness in that weirdness.
Yeah, and the weirdness is where I think hope is sitting.
Yeah.
I agree.
I agree. Yeah. Nora, I've really enjoyed this conversation. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts and your wisdom. And we'll put the book on the show notes so people can find it. And I really look forward to reading it. Lovely talking with you. Thank you so much.
So much. Thank you.